Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast. My name is Lindsay Roundtree. I am head of content at ExchangeWire and temporary sound guy for today, so apologies in advance. I am joined again by our CEO, Kieran O'Kane. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm great. Just been in Paris.
Yeah.
Wonderful city.
Yeah.
The
Beautiful weather.
Yes, and the French are upbeat about the future of our industry, which is remarkable.
Did you ride the metro?
No. We got Uber. It's a disgrace, really.
It is a disgrace, actually. Yeah. We didn't ride the metro once.
No, we just Ubered it around the city.
Yeah.
Very lazy.
Anyway, and our special guest today is James Prudhomme, who is EVP International at Index Exchange. Welcome, James.
Thank you.
James has a slightly bad cold, so if you hear coughing, blowing noses, we've got give him a Lemsip.
Poor Jimmy.
Which for non-UK people is cold and flu drugs, so hopefully he'll get through this unscathed.
Lemsip is the UK version of Neocitrin.
Yes, Neocitrin.
Is that the Canadian version?
That's the Canadian version. Yeah. Lemony Neocitrin.
Is it stronger or is it the same?
Oh, I would assume it's probably stronger.
Yeah.
We're very weak over here.
Well, strong regulations are in...
Exactly.
Pharma. Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Anyway, speaking of regulations, they'll probably come up at some point in this podcast.
That'll all change with the new free trade agreements.
I'm happy about
opioids!
That.
Opioids!
I'm very happy about that. Maybe not opioid addiction.
Oh, obviously not.
No. Stronger cold and flu drugs I'm all right
for. Very serious.
Anyway,
issue.
I'm going to kick us off with the first news story of this week, which you might have missed it amongst the furore of a tiny company mentioning something that was, not particularly important. Google talking about that they're going to be denigrating third-party cookies. But at the same time, at a similar time, the ICO, Simon McDougall, who is the exec director of technology at the ICO, released his latest blog post following on from the one he released in December. And the blog post basically said he was calling out the positive steps that have been taken in the industry. So he called out the IAB UK. And we've seen as well, the IAB UK have announced yesterday they're launching Gold Standard 2.0, which will include cooperation with TCF. So he called out the positive steps the IAB UK have been taking, and also called out Google for removing content categories, improving counterparts auditing processes, and lastly called out the other little thing they're doing, which is no longer supporting third-party cookies.
The IAB called out Google on that?
No. So the ICO, Simon McDougall, called out the IAB for their positive steps in helping to work with the ICO to ensure that RTB is being better traded. And then the ICO also called out Google, saying with the positive steps they're taking as well.
Ah.
So the steps they're taking in removing categories and in denigrating third-party cookies and their plans to phase them out.
Yeah.
But it wasn't all smiles and sunshine.
As
a little German friend of yours used to say, Kieran. So he's happy that other trade bodies are starting to actively engage with the ICO, but he is still accusing many companies of, and these are his words, firmly having their heads in the sand. So according to the ICO, now it's action time. Engagement alone with these companies clearly isn't working. So for them, it's not enough to just engage with these companies that keep failing them. Mm. Justifications offered by some companies that legitimate interest is a lawful basis is not sufficient, and an appropriate regulatory response will be issued. So read between the lines there.
About to find somebody.
Fines
are coming.
So he is both heartened and disappointed. Mm. Sounds like a headmaster that's, that those have ignored the ICO and now prepare to utilise their wider powers. Mm. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that. It feels like it was completely lost. Like hardly anybody picked it up because there was so much more news going on last week, which obviously they brought up. There's a lot of talk at the moment now about the fact that Google have done this. Does it mean that everything the ICO is pushing towards becomes kind of irrelevant because Google have done it for them to a certain degree? Is that viable? Is that actually true? And is the ICO now going to have to kind of fight harder to remain an important sort of scary figure in the regulatory scene of UK ad tech? Or are they still front and centre in it? Is everything that Google are doing, everything IAB UK doing, kind of the right approach? And are there still companies that aren't doing enough to make sure that they are following regulation and following the letter of the law? James, I'm going to start with you and your thoughts on this.
Great. Well, that's a lot to unpack. but that was a very good overview.
I like to just throw many things at you.
So thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, let me start with IAB UK. So, first of all, for disclosure purposes, we're on the board of IAB UK Index Exchanges, and we're actively engaged with IAB UK in their engagement with the ICO. So I think IAB UK is doing the right things. The level of engagement has been excellent. They've got really strong policy people, not ad tech people. but actual policy people who really understand.
Which
this
is the
stuff.
Correct approach, right? We have to make Absolutely. Sure that we are delineating exactly who should be speaking, having what conversations. With the regulatory people, which
that's absolutely right, and it's important.
Which is not the likes of you and me. You know,
the ICO doesn't owe the industry anything, right? The ICO doesn't have; they're not in business, or they haven't been empowered in order to make sure that ad tech companies, you know, stay in business. That's not their job. Their job is to protect the privacy of UK citizens and to ensure that privacy legislation, as enacted by the UK government, is enforced properly. And they're simply doing their job. So I think what IAB UK is doing at the level of engagement, I think, is really, really important. Mm-hmm. They're focused on data security, removing the special category data. So yes, Google is doing that, but IAB UK is taking actions there as well to prevent the use of the content taxonomy, which I think is great. They're also supporting the ICO's position in terms of legitimate interest, which I also think is important. So they're imposing legitimate interest assessments, which is a little known part of the GDPR, right? You can say, oh, no, we rely on legitimate interest. But under GDPR legislation, you're required to create a legitimate interest assessment. Mm-hmm. So any company that's doing that. And I would say that for the most part, in advertising and publishing, these legitimate interest assessments would probably not stand up.
Which is exactly what he's been saying in his blog post. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think, so that's the IAB portion. The other questions you asked.
So there is also they mentioned the steps Google have taken, which obviously you've touched upon, but the big step Google have taken that's impacted us massively over the past couple of weeks is the fact they will be phasing out their support for third-party cookies.
Yeah.
There's a feel amongst the industry, like from people we've been speaking to, from looking at kind of comments and reactions on LinkedIn and other platforms, that actually the ICO's stance on this now seems irrelevant because everything that these companies should be working towards, Google have effectively just done it for them. In phasing out third-party cookies and Chrome being the dominant browser, and obviously the fact that Safari and Firefox have gone down the same route as well, actually everything that these companies are working towards in terms of data privacy, Google have just gone and done, we don't need to do that anymore, we'll do it for you. So is there a need for the ICO to have this strong stance, or will it just kind of fall on the hands of Google to have made sure that everyone's going to kind of be compliant anyway?
I think that may be a simplistic view. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and just to be clear, I don't think it's correct to sort of say Google is eliminating the third-party cookie, right? It's the Chromium team that has announced that the third-party cookie will no longer be supported, I think, in a two-year time frame, mm-hmm. right? And Chromium is the open-source core on which Chrome is built, on which Internet Explorer is now built. I think Firefox is also built on Chromium as well. Because I think
Firefox is Chromium.
Yeah,
and Chromium. And for example, the Brave software as well, that is also built on Chromium. So,
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the Chromium team that made this announcement. And I think it's a little bit too simplistic to sort of say, hey, Chromium has announced that third-party cookie is going away. Therefore, the ICO can just, you know, kind of wash their hands of it and say, okay, done and dusted. I don't think that's accurate. I think that they're going to watch very closely how the industry reacts to this, what the industry will sort of coalesce around as a replacement, ensuring that that's privacy compliant. They will, you know, and it's still a two-year window. So it's not like, hey, we can go and just arbitrarily collect data on UK citizens between, you know, the next 48 months. So the ICO still has to ensure that today and at the moment that their enforcement policies are being affected.
Mm. Kieran, what are your thoughts on that, this kind of Google versus ICO stance?
I think that the point James made was that there's a two-year window until Google enact this crackdown on third-party cookie use on their browser, or Chromium's browser, whatever you want to look at, but on Chrome. So there is a window where bad behavior has to be slapped down, and the ICO have a time frame and have had a time frame for the last 2 years as to how they want ad tech to answer their questions around GDPR infractions. And legitimate interest is interesting because if you go to any of the apps, for instance, and we know some very big players, they're all relying on legitimate interest. They're not opted in for advertising on gaming, for instance. There's no. I'm not picking anybody out in particular, but there's a lot of companies that are trading on legitimate interest, and it's wrong in the eyes of the law. You need to opt in users for targeted advertising for particularly in RTB. I think Simon was right to sort of flag these infractions and fines are, it just seems that fines are coming down the tube. But in 2 years' time, we probably don't need this because...
Will it become irrelevant?
It will become irrelevant. But then there's the whole point about first party. Someone was trying to... I started this thread on LinkedIn yesterday because I really wanted to know what's the point of the TCF now when it was designed specifically to pass consent across multiple domains, right? So it can't do that in the new era. So you're kind of wondering...
It won't need to do that in the new era.
What's the relevance of it? But then someone said, well, you still have a lot of first-party cookies on page that you... But, you know, the TCF might evolve into kind of like a first-party entity, and maybe that's how these things go. But Google just have taken unilateral action and probably said, you know what? There's no point in us messing around. We want the user to control privacy at the browser level. And I guess that's the way things are going to go. I think that's, you know, if you're logical, that's probably the best way things go. I know it kind of flies in the face of what the industry's trying to do. Well, it should be the publisher that controls that, but it's too messy. And I guess having control at the browser level gives the user the type of insight and how their data is used. And that's just the way, that's maybe the way that e-privacy was being lined up for that. Or something, e-privacy, the e-privacy directive, which is the next iteration of GDPR, was basically pushing for that. And Google's just taken unilateral action there and just pushed it through. But I agree with James. I think the ICO is right. There is a 2-year window, and we can't let bad actors get away with what they were doing. So I think, you know, there's still a lot of dodgy stuff being happening in the space. Like, no consent has not been passed in the consent string. There's a lot of legitimate interest, which is not legitimate. I think Simon's right to keep rattling the cages, and it's good. Good to see you.
Mm. And your comment there about the valid question you asked on LinkedIn yesterday, which was, what is the future of the TCF? Because it feels like it will no longer be a requirement. And the future of the CMP within that as well, kind of what is a requirement of the CMP in the context of collecting consent from users within a for users on browser. And actually, it's a question that there's a lot of different people coming back with their views and their thoughts on how it works. And it's more simplistic. And actually, James, to your point about the denigration of third-party cookies in general, we're looking at it from a very simplistic perspective. Actually, interesting on your perspective on kind of how, say, the TCF and how a CMP still has value and will still be needed, rather than just kind of viewing at it, well, if there's no third-party cookie, there's no need for a CMP anymore. What's the point in having all these things kind of collecting consent when the consent will be irrelevant anyway? Well, there's so many different people, so many different kind of versions of understanding that I think we do need to kind of asking out the industry, kind of someone, let's try and clear it up and make it clear.
Yeah. I think it's incorrect to say that TCF 2.0 or TCF 1.0 is only about cookies, right? It's a transparency and consent framework. So something will replace the cookie. There will be identity tokens transacted on users, you know, whatever that may be. We certainly have a view, and we've made some big investments into what we think that future will look like.
But why would you need TCF for that?
Well, you still need consent.
Yeah, but then it's domain based, right? So you could have vendors who are outside TCF and the publisher controls the opt-in, right? Or like
because there will still be first party cookies, so it would occur, the consent would occur with there instead.
So I think what happens here is, and this feeds into how we think the space will evolve, right? That a lot of companies are going to reorg on what they are right now, because at the minute we have DSPs, DMPs, CMPs and
DSPs.
Maybe there's a new layer called a data activation platform which controls that. So does the TCF have to underpin that? No, because we're not sharing consent across domains. What we're sharing is, it could, like, if you think about how do you get, if you're going to have an SSL, right? Think about that, right? Because that's kind of where we're heading, single sign-on with 10 sites involved. So one sort of vendor controls that, or sorry, the collective publishers control that. And the vendor is the layer, right? But you're not sharing out that consent to the 150 cookie-based vendors that we had previously. It's a complete reorg of the industry.
Well, you still could share consent across domains. It's not necessarily to say that that completely goes away. You can't do it via cookie as the mechanics behind it. But
you're going to be sharing it with less players. You know what I mean?
So, for example, publishers, you know, a lot of publishers across Europe are investigated in single sign-on mechanisms, yeah. right? So that would still be sharing consent across domains. You wouldn't have to, if you sign in to use Axel Springer in Germany, you wouldn't then have to sign in again to use Der Spiegel or another, yes. you know, another property, right? So that consent could travel with the user.
Yeah, but do you need an open source tool like TCF to do that? This is the problem. It's the mechanics. I think the TCF was built for a time before ITP in mind, right? It was about how do we make RTE work in a GDPR compliant world? What I think the TCF didn't expect was Google to come in hard, right? We're getting rid of third-party cookies. Probably didn't expect Apple to come in hard either, or Firefox, but the whole industry's gone that way. It's gone privacy first. And now it's catch up. I'm not saying it's a waste of time, because we still have to, there's still a window we have to sort out. Like Chrome is still, there's a two-year window where that's still relevant. But I think the mechanics of the industry kind of completely change in the next 24 months that it will probably not be relevant. And that was my point in LinkedIn. And I'm not denigrating the work that the TCF has done, because it's not bad work. It was trying to build a model that complies with the current privacy laws. What it probably didn't perceive was a unilateral action by the Chromium team at Chrome, or the fact that Apple won't talk to the industry. We're covering this story in the next one, I guess. It's kind of a crossover.
We absolutely are. Don't steal my thunder.
No, I'm not stealing your thunder. But
how bloody
but
rude.
I'm just thinking about, you know, I think now it's how relevant will it be in the next 24 months? That was what I was trying to say. I wasn't trying to say, oh, IAB, you did a crap job there. Why are you wasting your time? And I don't think anything's a waste of time. I think it was a good sort of effort. And maybe, as you say, James,
it
evolves.
And don't forget, it still will be relevant for the next 2 years, at least until it evolves into whatever the next phase of that will look like.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that we're talking about TCF 2.0 indicates that it's an evolutionary process. So TCF 3.0 could look very different. I believe that the industry would still benefit from a common standard around a transparency and consent framework.
Mm.
I don't believe the need for that goes away just because the third-party cookie goes away. It'll look different. It'll be different.
Yeah.
It could be an entirely different standard, but it doesn't
need... could be blockchain related. It could be... I mean, no, I'm not saying...
Yep.
I mean, I suppose that's the nature of our industry. It changes so dynamically all the time. I'm just saying that the current model, I'm not going to go, oh, I don't get this because each publisher might have their own solution. Who knows? But I don't think it was a waste of time, in the sense that at the time it was built for a good purpose, which was basically letting the industry work in a compliant way.
Maybe we need to whiteboard this, do a trader talk, so we can visualize what the new version, what 2.0 and beyond will look like.
Well, we'd just basically doing the product development for all the ad tech companies.
That's true, actually. Bad idea. Terrible idea.
I know.
Well, I think it's also incorrect to say that the IAB team that manages TCF did not anticipate the third-party cookie going away. Like, they haven't had their heads buried in the sand. Like, anyone who's been in the industry and paid attention over the last 3 or 4 years, really... understood that eventually the third-party cookie was going away.
I don't know if they expected Google to do this, though. That was the sense I got.
Maybe we
have different opinions on that, but I got the sense that they didn't expect Google to kind of... Like, Google, like, has its own agenda. And as you said, James, there's many different moving parts within Google, right? So, you know, if you think about the display business they had, they've just got rid of all the DoubleClick. So it's all Google people within the DoubleClick display business now. Well, previously DoubleClick business. So maybe they don't care as much about display as they used to. So I don't know.
I mean, that's possible. Google, sure, has an agenda. They're a big, innovative company that has to keep growing. But they're also subject to externalities. And externalities like policy... and law passed by the governments of the countries in which they operate absolutely influences their thinking. Mm. Has to.
Yeah.
So, I don't think Google is the big bad monster in all of this.
No, neither do I. I think they've done us a favor. I keep saying that. I think they've done us a favor to innovate around them, because I don't want to have my future or our future in the industry to be dictated by one company. I think that's dangerous, and we've already discovered that's not a good strategy.
Yeah. I mean, the other, if you start to sort of unpack Google's strategy a little bit, they've also made a huge bet on the browser.
Yeah.
Right? The browser itself. So you'll see, I believe, in the future, this will bring kind of like apps into question, but you'll just see more and more investment go into the browser. If you see what Google is doing with its own apps, Google Analytics, for example, the Google AdSense app, they're all just going browser-based. They're eliminating those apps entirely. So if you're a Google Analytics user, you have that app running on your phone. In a few more months, you won't have the Google Analytics app running on your phone. You'll just have a shortcut, a Chrome shortcut. And it'll be all browser-based. So
the other thing as well, which is important, when we said this probably in a previous episode, that Google have a huge strategy around streaming games, and Chrome is such a huge part of that.
Yeah.
And for them to lose market share to Apple and to Firefox, you know, would be inconceivable now when they're trying to roll out this gaming solution. And it's, and remember, gaming is going to be a $300 billion business. They can't ignore that. So to sacrifice this for the growth of the browser. And there's no doubt in my mind that Amazon and Facebook will launch a browser as well, because they'll see the opportunity to own that user experience.
This is what I was going to ask. Do we see potential for new cookie-based browsers to crop up from the likes of Amazon or Facebook?
Doubtful.
Interesting.
Why? Yeah.
Well,
Amazon, I think, could do it.
You know, if you look at, like, you know, all of these companies are software companies at their core, and they're in the business of creating software across commonly accepted standards. So if those standards, like these, the reason why these things take years to put in place is, you know, hardware manufacturers and device manufacturers, they all have to think about, you know, the changes that are happening here, right? In the way that they create their devices, in the way that they structure things. Other software companies have to really consider these changes. So it wouldn't make sense for Amazon to put out a browser that adheres to a completely different set of standards.
Oh, yeah, I know. I wouldn't say they would adhere to standards, but they'd certainly think about owning that piece of software. I think it wouldn't be the worst idea in the world.
Yeah, very true. On that note, I'm going to move to second story.
Okay.
Which is the story from DigiDay from brilliant Lara O'Reilly.
Lara.
Yeah.
Love Lara.
There you go. Irish. A lot of love for Lara.
Good Irish lass.
Yeah. Well, 20 generations down. Yeah. Yeah, she keeps pointing out herself to me.
A bit back.
Yeah.
It is that publishers and marketers are mostly absent from the key group deciding what comes after the third-party cookie. So Google is going to be working with the World Wide Web Consortium, known colloquially as W3C, thank Christ, because that's quite a mouthful, to help come up with alternatives. The problem here is that there are very few publishers and advertisers that are actively involved and participate in W3C. And Google are apparently not said to be approaching IAB, ANA or the 4As, and they're instead calling upon the entire web ecosystem to provide its feedback via GitHub or by emailing the Improving Web Advertising Business Group, which is hosted by W3C. As far as we can see from Laura's article, from the kind of participants and members of this group that's hosted by W3C, only one publisher, which is Washington Post, and Wayfair, kind of the big marketplace brand, are active participants in this group of its 60 plus members, and the ANA and the 4As, which is the agency representatives in the US, are deeply disappointed that Google would unilaterally declare such a major change without prior careful consultation
across digital
advertising industries. Yes, well, so you've kind of answered my question already, really. So my question is this the right approach? We're not talking about an ad tech thing. This is bigger and beyond that. So are Google doing the right thing by making this a tactic to kind of get help and guidance and thoughts and feedback from the entire web ecosystem? And is it right to remove almost the emotion from these decisions and these solutions by not including advertisers and publishers? Or should they be involved in this conversation? Are they even technically ready to be able to be involved in these conversations? James, I want to start with you, kind of what your thoughts are on this, if it's actually just kind of stop moaning, crack on with your life.
Yeah, I mean, the W3C is absolutely the right forum. Right. You know, cookies are not exclusively owned by the advertising technology industry. And they're not the only constituents. Ad tech players and publishers and advertisers are not the only constituents that are impacted. Google is under no obligation to consult with these groups. And so the W3C is absolutely the right forum. IB Tech Lab is represented there. The Trade Desk is represented there. So clearly there's no barriers to organizations like the ANA, if they want to, or other ones, from getting themselves represented in that forum. And I think at the end of the day, like, the third-party cookie was never intended or designed for advertising. It was kind of a crutch.
Absolutely.
That the advertising industry took advantage of successfully. It was an innovation, if you want to look at it that way, which is great. But it's changing, and you have to get used to it. Mm-hmm. And there has to be other solutions that take its place. And so, you know, from our point of view, from the Index point of view, we started investing in identity, in an identity framework 3 years ago. And that identity framework is now transacting identifiers from a whole bunch of identity graph providers, including LiveRamp and others across Europe and in the US. We think that that identity framework is going to form the core of how our publishers and our advertisers and buyers transact with one another. So we've been prepared for this for a long time. And we have a lot of work to do to encourage further adoption. But I don't think that it's correct to say that Google is not providing sufficient opportunity for consultation with the ad tech industry. I think that's a misnomer.
Kieran?
I totally agree with that. I think that Google have made it an internet issue as opposed to an advertiser or advertising issue.
Which is what it should be.
It should be that way. I mean, why does a marketer or a brand or an agency think they have a monopoly over how cookies are used in the internet? Because they're, as James said, it's a piece of JavaScript. Every website has JavaScript, and it's used in some shape or form, whether for logins or for various aspects of functionality of a website beyond just retargeting, right, and measurement and tracking. I think this is a good thing. To be honest, it's very easy to kind of rail against Google. Oh, the evil guy, look what they've done. But I think they've done the industry a real favor. They're cleaning it up in the best way possible and actually getting the collective internet involved in what should be possible, what's right according to privacy regulations is the best way to go. It's the cleanest way to go. And once we have a rule book, we'll all be able to adhere to it on the internet. And
it's a reset.
It's a brilliant reset. I think it's necessary. Like we're like almost like junkies. I don't know, like it's a bit like when Renton was coming off the
heroin. That's a great analogy. Where's this going?
Yeah, well, when Renton was coming off the heroin and train spotting and he's going through the cold turkey. And I think that's where we're going right now. When the baby starts climbing the wall and does the 360, like, you know, it's pretty terrifying stuff. But I think that's where a lot of people need to go and get this out of their system. There are fundamental issues in the industry for sure. There is the whole ID piece, right? You know, which will be solved by either login or probabilistic modeling or machine learning. Then there's the measurement piece, which I think could be solved by panel-based measurement, getting hundreds of thousands of people logged in on a Chrome add-on and being able to measure via that. I think these problems are solvable. It's just when you've grown used to one way of doing things, which is the cookie, right? It's just so easy. And there's thousands of companies who've basically built businesses off the back of it. It's just not possible anymore. And you as a company in ad tech now have to add value, right? Whether it's activating data, first party data, whether it's measurement or whether it's contextual. I just think there's a lot of people who've got comfortable and it's just a shock to the system. And I think advertisers have got used to being able to sort of have this kind of like almost, you know, micro-targeted sort of world, right? And it's probably been to the detriment of online advertising. You look at the growth of, like, out of home, which still is archaic in many ways, is growing, right? Audio is growing. Whereas our industry is controlled by two companies that have an absolute, you know, have the industry by a throat, by the neck. And it's time to break free of that. And I think Google, in a way, is kind of almost saying, you know what, this is going to hurt us as much as the rest of the industry, but we're prepared to take that on the chin because they've got bigger ambitions. Let's be honest with you. Google make all of their money from Google.com, YouTube.com, and they're going to have a huge business around gaming, right? If they control that ecosystem, it's going to be $100 billion business for them potentially or more. They're looking at the bigger picture. And I think, as an industry, we have to as well. I think there's huge opportunity and we just have to get on with it. We'll stop crying. Let's move on.
That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, so inspiring.
Well, I think that we need just to kind of just stop crying.
Yeah.
Right, get on with it.
Put up or shut up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree, absolutely. And, you know, it's not going to change. All the whinging in the world is not going to change the reality. And so we do absolutely have to come together as an industry. we've been saying this for quite some time, really. You know, if you look back over the last 2 or 3 years and sort of our talk track at conferences and events and other places has always been around this, always been around identity, always been that the cookie is going away. So let's start coalescing around a solution and keep it really solutions focused. So no question, we're really positive about it. We remain committed to it. We're excited about the change. And we're not, you know, going to participate in sort of whinging around how Google should be kinder and gentler to everybody.
And that's not never the case, because Google's an absolute animal of a company, and like all good companies.
Yeah, and I think the important thing, like the theme that kind of runs through a lot of what you just said and what we've been talking about, is the notion that publishers have to understand how much value they have. Mm. Users want their content, and users have to understand that they just can't access that content you know, quote unquote, for free. Mm-hmm. People who create that content have to get paid. People who distribute that content have to get paid. A lot of people have to get paid. And so users will have to get used to a new paradigm.
Yeah.
Whether that's a browser extension, good idea.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You know,
I stole it from you.
consent management platforms are going to be in an interesting sort of place. But users will have to consent and agree to the use of an identity token that is not a third-party cookie. That can be consistent across domains to be able to serve them with relevant targeted advertising.
And it's, you could argue,
need is not going to go away.
You could argue, just following on for that, James, you could argue it's a recalibration of the economic model on the internet, right? It's like there are no free lunches, right? People have to get paid for content, and content is not infinite. Good content is finite. As we know ourselves, we might have 6 or 7 websites we go to in a week, whether it's a Canadian newspaper, or an Irish newspaper, or a British newspaper, or just a general financial newspaper, or a special interest, or sports, or whatever. You have a finite, and that is a fact. So as you say, James, publishers need to understand the value of what they have and have a relate. Remember, the publishers in this are going to do really well, because it's not ad tech and it's not the agencies and it's not the marketers that have the relationship with the users. It's the publishers. I think they're in a really good spot here if they can work it out. I think they're the ones to have the one-to-one relationship with me, you, the reader, right?
Mm.
And if they can figure out how they can... Remember, that I think the thing is, how do you move towards that paradigm that James talked about? So UX is something important. So the user experience, how do you get them to log in without being the horrible, shitty process? We have multiple pop-ups. That's going to be really important. And we'll get there. It might take 12 months, it might take 24 months, but I think we've already seen it from the likes of The Telegraph announcing that they've got a lot of logged in users. And we're going to our next story as well.
I mean, stop doing this to me.
I'm sorry, it's getting really annoying. But there's a lot of good publishers who are getting ahead of this. And I think that the authenticated web, the logged in web, is where the value is going to be in the future. The CPMs go through the roof.
But this is an interesting question, and it, I guess, coming from the consumer perspective as well. As Ciaran said, we will get onto kind of publishers and what publishers could get out of this, and how they will diversify and evolve. But from a consumer perspective, there's this kind of, will they have to understand the value exchange that we've spent so many years talking about? Like, consumers have to understand the value exchange. If you want free content, you're going to have advertising. And it feels like now that we're talking about the value exchange in a different context, because it feels like we were just using that as a way to justify the terrible things we were doing in terms of how we were abusing our right to advertise to these consumers. Will the value exchange need to be understood differently by what a consumer gets for what they give in return versus what it used to be? If that makes sense. That was a roundabout question.
So I think the short answer is yes, right? Consumers absolutely have to adapt to a new paradigm and a new understanding of that value exchange. And all of the things Ciaran said about content are absolutely true. It doesn't come for free. It is finite. It's not endless, despite that it feels endless when we scroll through, you know, Facebook and other places. And so users have to get used to that. You know, the risk is, of course, in all of this, is that Google, Facebook, and maybe Twitter become the only platforms through which you can consume all of this content. But I don't think anybody wants that, and I don't think that benefits anybody. So I don't think that risk, I don't think there's a high probability of that outcome. So I think that publishers will get it together. They'll figure out single sign-ons. They'll understand that they have to be slightly more aggressive with users in terms of just saying no once in a while. The European courts are going to have to interpret that particular piece of GDPR differently, I believe.
Yeah.
Interesting.
My personal opinion, I'm not a lawyer, but that to me...
I think there will, James. I think there's too many... there's a lot of German publishers and French publishers that have the ear of the government. It's not so much here. I mean, even here it is. But it's this, if we want to preserve an independent press in a world where... three fecking U.S. companies control the debate in our continent.
I think that's right.
I think that's, and I think that particular thing about, you know, forcing users to log in for content, it's very fluffy anyway. It's very ambiguous. So, I mean, Facebook were brought to court in Austria on that very topic, and they said, well, look, if we don't get people to log in, it breaks the whole system, right? So a publisher could re-engineer the whole website and say, that's good. Use that case. Facebook has done us a favor because they're obviously a big target. So I think we're going to get around this. I don't think anybody's going to be taken to court. Who the hell in their right mind is going to take a publisher who's actually... hiring journalists, paying for journalists, and preserving freedom, whether it's a left leaning paper or a right leaning paper, and it encourages debate in the country, is going to take them to court and fine them because they're forcing users to log in to content that is nonsensical. It's almost like somebody can go to a sweet shop and have all the sweets and they won't have to pay any currency because it's there. That's a ridiculous communist. It's absolutely crazy.
Oh, the road you go down, unbelievable.
That's right. That one article, that one piece, gets me really pissed off. It really angers me because all that is an attack on content producers, really good content producers, and their right to make money. Right, their right to make money for what they've done. Right, we're not here to put free content in it. That's an utter bullshit statement, and I think GDPR needs to be reflected. I agree 100%, James. That'll be tested in court of law by not one publisher, but a collective of publishers, and having a smart lawyer.
Yeah, probably right.
And getting government support.
Mm.
Yeah, that'll be an outcome that I'm. That'll be something I'll be watching really, really closely to see when that happens, because I think it's when, not if. And publishers have to, you know, assert their independence, right, and assert their authority. Because it will be a battle for the environment. Right? They'll have all kinds of new opportunities as Chrome evolves without the use of cookies. They'll have all kinds of opportunities to create robust environments to engage users with content and or advertising. So they're going to have to get innovative around that. And they're going to have to band together a little bit to sort of toughen up against Google and Facebook. Otherwise, we will fall into a world where Google News becomes the only place you can actually consume news.
Which is the nightmare dystopia. Like, it really is.
It really is. Yeah.
Well, nobody wants... Like, we have to talk about this from a geographical point of view. Google is an American company, right? And maybe they act global, but they're an American company. We can't have...
I thought they were an Irish company.
Well, they just basically siphon all their and also don't pay any tax. I mean, like... We can go into all sorts of...
I mean, let's not, because we are running out of time.
It's a black hole.
And you're just going to start going off on one.
I've been holding myself back.
I'd rather not.
You should just do a separate podcast.
You were doing
on
so
Google.
Well until we got to the 38th minute and you've now started to fuck it up.
I'm not fucking it up.
Okay, good. And
let's be honest, I've been very... I don't blame Google. I just think, as James said, we need to get together, band together to build a system that's, you know, equal for everybody.
Yes.
Google can still make money. We're all happy with
let's
that.
Just let's just not go into their tax status.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, moving on. So, a heartwarming story next to bring us out of Kieran's ranting turmoil. So, this is a story about New York Times, obviously very well-known publication in the US, and it has passed its goal of $800 million in annual digital revenue a year ahead of plan. Now, you might be like, okay, that's fine, whatever. If you didn't know kind of what...
I'm a subscriber.
Okay, there we go. James Prom is a subscriber. You might well be after the chat about this. You might decide you want to be.
Well, I subscribe to the Irish Times, the Sunday Business Post in Ireland, and I'm an FT subscriber and a Wall Street Journal. So I help the ecosystem.
You help the ecosystem, absolutely. But many of you may not quite realise what dire straits the New York Times was in, listeners.
A mess.
So in 2012, 8 years ago, former Director General of the BBC in the UK took on the massive challenge of turning around New York Times. He became president and chief exec. Basically, it was in a situation where it had lost hundreds of millions of dollars in print advertising. It was so bad it had to sell and then lease back its own Manhattan headquarters. And it was and Mark Thompson was brought to try and turn this mess around. It didn't really know what direction it had to go in, and it just knew it couldn't carry on the way it was. And a really nice part of this is that kind of a reflection of them is that one of the most important things New York Times actually wrote in 2019 was a check for $246 million, which was to pay off the last debt they'd taken. That's amazing. How much they turned things around. And they're now planning to buy back their office. So it's amazing what you can do in 8 years. Mm. So hats off to Mark Thompson on this. But they hit their ambitious target, generating $800 million in annual digital revenue a year ahead of schedule. This target was set by Thompson in 2015, and the focus has been serving readers on mobile devices, fresh digital formats, including video and audio. They have a very successful podcast. They've got very successful video content as well. And it now has more than 5 million paying subscribers with a massive potential for international growth. They're doing very well in the UK, for example, and it has set a new target for 10 million subscribers, so doubling it by 2025. Millennials are their largest audience demographic. That's who they're going after. But it feels like this could be a beacon of hope for many publishers in the UK and outside the UK as well, for this is how you can turn a company around. And it looks like the subscription is the future. So I've got your thoughts in general on how the MIT have done this, but also kind of if every publisher should be looking at a sub-model, or if it only really works for certain types of publishers. New York Times isn't necessarily just a news publisher now. They have lots of different aspects as well. They have, food magazines. They have a podcast. They're becoming almost a next generation publisher in their diversification. So maybe for someone like them, subscriptions work really well. Maybe it would work for everyone. Maybe it wouldn't. Kind of how in this current climate, particularly given the news that we've been getting from what the future publishers are with Google, and everyone talks here, and you just mentioned it, that now is a massive time for publishers. They've got huge opportunities to win in this climate, in this environment. Is this the approach? Should we be looking to MIT as a beacon of hope? James, as subscriber, over to you.
And also a supporter of The Guardian. And so I would say, yes, great, excellent execution to The New York Times. They've done a great job. I love the publication. I love reading it. And, in the dark years of, the paywall, I was like, yeah, I actually really miss it. So it's worth me paying whatever it is, £7 a month or £6 a month or something, I think I pay. But I would also just to sort of point out, like, New York Times, great. Guardian has done an equally good job.
Absolutely.
Of turning it around, becoming profitable. Different, sort of dynamic there. They have the endowment and all of these things. But nonetheless, UK newspapers are also doing a good job. So to get to your question around, does it work for every publisher? No.
No.
Right. It works for big premium publishers who have amazing brands that, stretch back decades. Unfortunately, the ecosystem of small, local, regional, and sort of small town and small village newspapers have not been able to crack the code on subscriptions, right? Users probably have a finite number of subscriptions that they can kind of hold or maintain. Publisher consortiums, and, we talk about login consortiums, we haven't really seen yet a subscription consortium, which I think could be really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. In certain countries, right? And certainly Apple News and some of the aggregators have tried this model. I really don't know how successful it is.
Not very successful, from what I hear.
I think that's right. Yeah. Mm. I don't think publishers sort of see a lot there. That may change as more and more publishers just start to, put up paywalls and, stop serving content to users for free, which could be a necessary imperative because of the changes that are happening to advertising and cookies. We'll see how that plays itself out. But there's no question, I have not been to a conference in the last 3 years where subscriptions and subscription revenues did not play, a hugely important role in terms of the content and the focus of that event.
Interesting.
APAC, same thing. I was at a conference in Hong Kong about 4 or 5 months ago. Exact same thing.
It's interesting, right? We had a fascinating chat here on You and I with a French publisher yesterday.
Yeah, amazing
a
company.
Publisher collective. They have multiple different publications, titles underneath their belt, and they are looking at sub-models for certain publications, but for others, they know it won't work. Mm. So, for example, they've got one title, which is a science-related title. It's educational. And because of its uniqueness in the market, they are able to be very successful with subscriptions.
Yeah.
But they completely appreciate that any titles they have that are around consumer, female, beauty, automotive, if they were to put up a paywall, there'll be 40 other publications in the French market that that user could go to instead.
Yeah.
So that is was a great example for us hearing that about it doesn't work if there's plenty of content around that they can just go to instead. If you're looking for car reviews, why would you go and pay for that when you can find it somewhere else instead? But if you're able to bring something unique, a unique offering to a reader, they are much more likely to pay for it. And that, I think, is what the New York Times are proving they're doing, what The Guardian as well are proving they're doing. So many times you might go, if you're not a subscriber to The Guardian, for example, you read an article, you try and read an article, you get kind of blocked out. And then you try and find that somewhere else and you can't. And it's because they are wanting you to pay for the unique content they have written by expert journalists, expert writers. And that is ties in with what we were talking earlier about. That's the value exchange now.
I mean, like, you could argue that, the job that Mark Thompson's done at the New York Times is phenomenal. But, like, the New York Times is always a strong brand, right? What it had to do was evolve to the new world. And you could argue the New York Times is much more than just a newspaper. It's a media, it's an omni-channel brand because a lot of the content is video related. So it's just sort of like fills the gap to what a lot of users need. And it's a great story, 800 million. And if they get to 1.6, their stock is underrated at the minute. It should be more. And, you know, I agree with James. It's going to be a few publishers that can do this at scale, right? So you could argue that your national newspapers of record, so the Irish Times is a far better newspaper than the Irish Independent in Ireland, in my view. It's just it's the paper of record. And
are they both paywalled?
No, the Independent is not paywalled, but it's more reliant and heavily on advertising, and it's actually user experience is fucking horrible. Whereas the Irish Times is a much more slick, user-friendly experience. And, you know, I want to support the local journalism, and it's very independent in its mindset. And it's not owned by the Independent now is owned by the same Dutch company that owns the Telegraph. So it's kind of independent. But certain brands will do well. But then there's other mid-market publishers that are really going to struggle. Like, you know, certain tabloids, are you really going to subscribe to that? And then the local press obviously have their own problem, but I think they need to evolve the model to become more like almost like an agency model, in the sense that helping local brands kind of figure out the internet, but obviously it helps that fund the news. That's a different story. But niche publications and big brand premium publishers are going to do well. The Athletic, I mean, there was this story in Axios as well about all of the brands hitting profitability, like The Athletic, which is an interesting pay for a newsletter subscription. It's 100 million revenue, which is phenomenal. There's the BuzzFeed, which are nearly profitable now as well, but based on their diversification, because obviously they've got, you know, DTC products. They're doing like kitchenware and all that stuff. So I think publishers are in a really interesting time now. Like, it's not just advertising. Their models are very diversified. That publisher we've seen in Paris, you talked about, Lindsay, they have, you know, interesting models, not just advertising. So they have like, they almost have like a panel-based solution for CPG brands like L'Oreal, who helped them test new products in the Southeast Asian market. And it's a fantastic model, but completely not dependent on advertising. It's more about the brand pays them for a panel-based solution. And I think the publishers are getting smarter about what they're doing. It's not just ads on pages, whether it's subscription or DTC products. They're evolving their models. And I think this is a good time to be a publisher, because remember, that one-to-one basis becomes important now, particularly in a time when cookies are becoming, you know, third-party cookies are going to become phased out. The ability for you to have that relationship with the user becomes even more important, because if you have them logged in, the CPMs for that user are going to be huge, because the passerby traffic, what use is it? You can't measure it. You can't target on it. Like, you can do the contextual.
So that's the question. If you aren't in a position to be able to go after the subscription model, like, say, we chatted last week with Lauren Dick from Mail Metro Media, that's a great example. You are now trying to force those users to log in. So you're kind of have to, James, you mentioned earlier, kind of hit your users much harder, kind of work with them much harder to get them to log in, because this passerby traffic, will you not be able to monetize it anymore. So that's the next stage with the cookie news would be try and get logins.
Correct. That's certainly the bet that we've made from, you know, for our identity framework. We really think that there is going to be the authenticated web and the unauthenticated web. And I think the unauthenticated web is not going to be a place that anybody wants to spend any significant amount of time.
Affiliates.
affiliates, you know, and certainly a lot of publishers have, you know, if you look at Future Publishing has done, right, super innovative, done a really, really great job. Dennis Publishing in the UK done a really great job selling, what are the number I saw, like they sold 40 million pounds worth of cars online.
Yeah, they bought the entire supply chain for cars. So they started off in reviewing them. And then they bought the entire chain. So you could not review them. We could also buy them here. At it's an amazing model.
It's an amazing model. Vertical integration. You know, it gets back to what I said earlier. Advertisers and brands will always want to influence purchase decisions. And users will always want to consume great content. So you put those two things together and it's a recipe for innovation.
Mm.
Right? That's why I don't think the world is ending when the cookie goes away and whatever. You know, we've invested heavily in an identity framework. We think that the next step of the evolution is moving toward the authenticated web versus the unauthenticated web. Not to say there will be zero monetization in the unauthenticated web. There'll be some contextual whatever. There'll be ways and innovative ways that people can extract value from that. You know, but the authenticated web is definitely the future that we see. And so we encourage publishers to really start thinking about what that looks like. Login consortiums, great idea, especially at a country level. The Germans are all over it.
They are.
The French are all over it. I think that, you know, the Brits need to get all over it, quite frankly. Common subscription models. You know, the advantage of a subscribed user is you also have a logged in user. So it's kind of a double whammy. They're paying you a fee to access the content and you can show them advertising. And maybe publishers will be like, hey, it's $2 a month if you don't mind looking at advertising. If you really hate ads and you're posh, you got a few extra quid, it's $5 a month.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is,
and you're posh, of course. Yeah.
And you're posh, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, the Guardian model is interesting, which I actually like. They get a lot of criticism for it, but I actually think it's a good model, which is like, hey, we're doing really important work.
I don't like it.
Please support us.
I'm not a massive fan either.
But, I don't like it. It's almost like begging bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, good for them if it works. It just feels a bit like, please, I don't like the Guardian being like that. I think it's a strong brand. It's got its ability to get people to pay for content is they're underrating it. I actually think they should be milking it more. I'd certainly pay for certain aspects of the paper if they asked me to.
I don't like this.
Help me out, bullshit. Like, do your friend a favor. I feel like it's like our mate sleeping on the couch, you know, but he hasn't left the place in 6 months.
I would be willing to bet, personal opinion, that their audience responds better to a message of, hey, we're doing important work, please help us out, than they would to a message of, hey, you have to pay to access this content.
But you could you could blend both of them, you know.
Maybe, but regardless, they've done a great job.
I think it's great.
They've executed really well.
Good for them. Mm-hmm. It's not my cup of tea, but going back to this, there's always the naysayers in the industry, right? And the New York Times is a very good example of executing over a period of time, a really good strategy. We're going to do the paywall. We're going to put people to it. And it's just a matter of training behavior. I'm sure when we first saw it, when New York Times first put up, nobody's going to pay for that. Nobody's going to pay for content online. Content should be free. That kind of rubbish. And what's happened over an 8-year period is that behavior has been trained. What people have realized is the New York Times has valuable premium content, right? That is not available on the web. They've got fantastic writers. They've got a global view, which sort of chimes very well with people who are progressive and left-leaning. Well, not left-leaning, but they have a very progressive view of the world. The world is not just through the lens of feckin' Fox News, right? It's actually, we can do better here. We can improve. We're not idiots.
Here we go again.
No, but they've got very much and I think that chimes with a lot of people and say, you know, I want to get that content. It says a lot to me. And likewise, if you want people to kind of to log in, right, it's going to take a trained behavior because at the minute it's just content's free. Suddenly a login comes in. Oh, I don't like that. But it's a matter of just training behavior. People get users used to, if you want this content, you have to log in.
Yeah.
And that's going to take
as well. It won't work with everyone.
No, exactly. But that's going to take time. But eventually you'll see the number of people who've done it go from 2% or 3% to 20% to 30% to 40%. And a matter of time, you'll get a high 67% people logging in. Right. And that is just going to happen. But the problem is a lot of the publishers still are scared to do it. You know, we're going to lose all this traffic. Well, you're going to lose it anyway because you're not going to be getting money from Chrome, Firefox and Apple. You're better off doing it now. Take the plunge, take the hit for the next couple of quarters and then you'll see it rising because I'm with you in this, James. The authenticated web is where all the real revenue is going to be, right? If you're serving a video ad now, you're getting what, £10 CPM, right? Authenticated web, it could be 50, it could be 60, you know, because it's a finite.
So it's a good point, right? The authenticated web, logged in users, the efficacy of the advertising served to a logged in user is going to be much higher than the efficacy of advertising served to a cookied, quote unquote, user. So the value of advertising goes up as well. Will it be enough to offset
the passerby?
Yeah. Like, we'll see. Time will tell.
Yeah.
And it'll be a challenging time for publishers. Like, I'm very optimistic and very positive, but I'm also very aware of the realities and that it will be a very, very challenging time for publishers. But let's get at it, right? Let's start working together. Let's, start collaborating and let's start innovating. So I think that it's an exciting, never waste an opportunity from a good crisis.
Never waste a good crisis.
Yeah, I love that.
I think it's an absolutely unbelievable opportunity to reset. And I know like during these times it's going to be hard because people are going to lose their jobs and businesses might not make it. But from the rubble, you're going to see some really good companies and a really healthy ecosystem. And I think it's a great time to be in the industry. It really is.
Absolutely. And on that note, because I'm done with hearing your voice now.
Sorry.
Let's move on to, and we've been talking about this a lot, James, and we just talked about it kind of from the authenticated web and everything else, all the stuff that Index is doing. And it feels like everything we've talked about in this podcast today really ties in with what is your big focus for the next, I guess, one to 5 years, really.
Sure.
So what are the big things that you're seeing and what are the big things that you guys are focusing on?
I mean, definitely identity, as we've talked about a lot, right? And continued investment into our identity framework, continued adoption of the framework. So we'll be announcing very, very soon, launching with multiple identity graph partners in Europe. So that's, you know, something that's happening in the next few weeks. It's, our focus has largely been in the US with LiveRamp, with Roundel, with the Merkle M1 identifier. We're now, you know, and a lot of innovation has happened, a lot of testing has gone on and a lot of success. So we're now rolling that out globally. And that's all part of our drive to become people-based, which we think is an absolute essential outcome for us. We are very focused on omnichannel, so big investments into mobile app, video, in the short term and in the medium term, digital out of home, digital audio, all of these things. Omnichannel is a huge, huge opportunity for us. And as I was saying earlier, you know, we were seen as sort of, you know, we weren't the market leaders in app and video. We have been a little bit behind the market, which is okay. That's because we made such a big investment into identity. So now as we launch those new formats, native is on the roadmap, all of these things, they will be infused with identity and with our identity framework. So we think we're really on the right track there. And then just continued global expansion, which is under sort of my remit personally. A lot of expansion into APAC, opening an office in Singapore this year.
We'll see you in Singapore then.
We'll definitely see you. I won't be
brilliant.
In Singapore.
Why not? What?
Because Kate and I are expecting another baby.
Hey! Another AdTech baby.
Another AdTech baby on the 6th of July. And the Singapore event is the 15th of June, so that is just cutting it a little.
She might not love it if you go to Singapore.
No can for you, though.
Well, the trade-off is, if I don't go to Singapore, Cannes is not that far away. So
what's the week after?
It is the week after, and it might be. I haven't been to Cannes in the last few years, largely because I go to Singapore and I spend the whole week. And so it's just too much to do, you know, back to back.
Yeah.
So maybe this year you might see me make an appearance at Cannes. Maybe depending on how Kate is feeling, I'll take her along with me. We'll take the train to Marseille or something, because she won't be able to fly. So that's why it won't be in Singapore.
Well, so like it would be, she'd be giving birth on a ad tech boat in Cannes.
Don't even say
on the OpenX boat.
Don't even say that. That's
Do
a
not
recipe.
Wish those things on
that's
people.
That's a recipe for divorce, right there. And my wife, bless her heart, really like. Doesn't care about ad tech, doesn't get involved in the industry.
She's right.
She's completely detached from it, which is wonderful for me. So I don't have to go home and talk about work.
Yeah.
But I will be making, you know, monthly and even more frequently than not, bi-monthly trips to Asia between now and end of May or middle of May. So going in a couple of weeks to Hong Kong, Digiday in Kyoto, We're doing a launch event in Tokyo. I'll be going back in March again. So big focus for me. APAC is really, really exciting opportunity.
Yeah.
As you guys know, we've taken a very measured approach to APAC, growing over time. But now it's, you know, shit's getting real, Kieran.
We have the biggest programmatic or data-driven marketing event in Asia.
You do. It's awesome. Yeah?
2 days in Singapore, and it is absolutely massive. Everybody from the region. So I completely... The opportunity in Asia is huge.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of... I would say... I'm not just to denigrate like the US or the European market, but it feels like there's a lot of innovation, a lot of excitement. Just feels the future is a bit more brighter in terms of like, you know, what people can do. And it's a very different marketplace in the sense of, you know, in-app is the go-to. It's the currency of how you interact with content in that market.
You're right. There's so many exciting things that come out of that region from a content point of view. You know, when I was at a conference in Hong Kong, there was a guy, I can't recall his name, he made a presentation about this guy, Michael Bryan, is that his name? And he's a rapper that comes from Jakarta. And he had a YouTube video that just like went to the moon. And it's like this 19-year-old kid from Jakarta who like absolutely has taken the hip-hop world by storm. He just played in London at the O2. He's a spokesperson now for the largest bank in Indonesia. There's just so much exciting stuff that's happening in that region.
Yeah. Yeah,
I love really that is.
we love that event.
To be a part of that in some way.
We do. It's a brilliant event.
We love Singapore and the whole region. So yeah. It's good.
Rich Brian.
I might have to look at him.
Yeah, look at Rich Brian. Yeah. It's awesome. Really, really cool.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Right. That feels like a good note to end this on.
There you go.
Rapping, why not?
Are you going to do a rap? Do you want to battle?
Will we battle each other?
Don't make the poor man cold.
But as I said, I have been watching the Dr. Dre, Jimmy Iovine.
I do like that show.
Jimmy Iovine's just like such a dude. Like,
yeah, he is.
You know, 21 years old.
I could say in a couple of years, you might look a bit like him.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. 21 years old, and he was engineering John Lennon's record at the record place in New York. Like,
yeah, Andre. I mean, they're both remarkable men. It's just an interesting.
By the time
Jimmy Iovine met Dre in the 90s, Jimmy Iovine was producing hit records in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
Tom Petty. He was married to. I can't recall her name.
Cold addled brain you have.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, we would recommend to our listeners to have a look at that. And also the hip-hop documentaries on Netflix. Four seasons. Very, very good.
Very cold and radio. Out. So
we're looking at an ad tech. We're talking to Netflix a bit about an ad tech series, The History of Ad Tech.
Yeah, when will Netflix offer an ad-supported version? It could be quite, that'll be good for the industry.
Never.
They will never do that. I've for many years, I've believed they would do, but they...
Well, they got to keep growing.
Somebody keeps saying...
Eventually, they'll run out of people who are willing to pay...
Exactly.
£10 a month.
And they keep threatening to raise the prices as well.
Cheap, right?
Yeah, exactly.
No.
They're going to come under increased competition now from Disney and from other providers in the US.
Peacock would be interesting because it's
Peacock would be funded.
That's a good play by NBC, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
we could have a whole podcast.
Really, really weird diversion at the end of the podcast there to wrapping. But now back onto topic about CTV. On that note, I want to say thank you very much to my guest and annoying CEO, Kieran O'Kane.
Jesus, that's a bit rough.
Well,
that was well behaved, eh?
You were okay behaved.
Oh, thank you.
You lost it a bit.
Well, when I get the tax and Google, it just drags
exactly.
me.
Exactly.
There's a switch inside my
off
head.
Off he goes. And thank you to, he's just having a coughing fit, James Prudhomme. Thank you for coming in and coming up all those stairs with a stinking cold.
Yeah,
great job.
Not too many coughs.
Considering you've got that Chinese thing. Put on.
Yeah. Hope you don't have that. Thank you for coming in. It's been great to have you.
Great to have you. Great to be here. Thank you. I always feel welcome with this team. So, looking forward to more collaboration with you guys in 2020.
Wonderful. On that note, awesome. This has been this week's Mad Tech Podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks.